Brandon, I appreciate your talk. I know you did what you're supposed to do. I kind of wish James had been after you so that this had been set up, he could have answered it as he did. One of the answers, Jesus gave an answer in regards to this. I learned from those guys put out, like Bert Thompson and Wayne Jackson, their literature. They put out a deal a few years ago, which showed Matthew 19, where Jesus quotes two places out of the Old Testament in regards to the marriage question. And because he quotes them, of course, it validates both lines. And if you were to look at it, the way they break them up, I think it was a J and a P text, is the way they call it. And this was a great comfort to me to find this little piece, and as well as reading other documents, Jesus quoting Jonah validates Jonah's the reality of it, as Megari goes through. Are there other texts like that you know of that kind of help validate? We don't have to worry about if there were more than one author, fine, but Jesus, he validates it. He says it's good. Are there any other texts like you know of like that?
Well, there would be texts where Jesus refers to the law of Moses. Anytime the scriptures talk about Moses said, that of course refers to those passages in the Pentateuch that talk about the law. And whereas any passage that talks about some historical event, whether it's Sodom and Gomorrah or Jonah or some other similar historical event, Jesus is validating that historical event, not only the event itself, but the history behind it, because of course he was talking to Jews who were acquainted with the history that they read from the Old Testament writings.
Richard? Raymond, I thought your talk was very informative and very good. And this is just for information's sake. Has any of the documentary hypothesis or this reader-centered idea, has that crept into our thinking and our teaching, do you think?
No.
Okay.
Where you'll find this is in doing research, using other reference materials. So you have to be careful of the kind of reference materials you use. Because sometimes those reference materials make declarations that are not necessarily true about the history. One, let me just say one thing. I think you're going to say something else. But let me say something about how it can creep in. Is that archaeology? It can be a really prejudiced form, really a prejudiced science, you might say, just like the study of evolution. Because a lot of archaeologists, when they go to interpret the data, it's one thing to dig up something; it's another thing to interpret it and put it in its right time frame. And just like an evolutionist will cover up a piece of bone and say, well, this dates back to so-and-so million, so many million years ago, the only reason why he can make that statement is because of his theory and not because there's some evidence of to be able to date that bone at that period of time. It's only because of certain presuppositions he makes about his theory that he can date that piece of that fragment of bone at that time. The same is true with some archaeologists when they interpret the data, they interpret it in view of a certain perspective on history, such as monotheism developing out of polytheism. And so we have to be careful about sometimes archaeologists making declarations about certain finds based on their presuppositions. What were you going to say?
You alluded to it, the reference books. Are there reference books that are maybe popular or might be common among us that would espouse some of these ideas? What are some of the commentaries maybe that give this documentary hypothesis?
I can't tell you right now offhand because I didn't really spend much time trying to find out what commentaries support what they support. I really can't answer that because I really didn't spend much time.
Jimmy? the example you raised on the board of Exodus 7 is a good example to show that people can get so smart they are outsmart themselves, to where it's really just ridiculous or stupid. It's we have to almost be, you know, complete foolish people to accept something like that. But that 621 date, of course, 621 is when Josiah was doing his repurposing of the temple and found the law, and that's the exact date. And so they attach some significance to that. And I don't know exactly how they come to these conclusions. I think they have to do some jumping, you know, that's wider than the Grand Canyon to come to these conclusions.
Their point is that when the book that Josiah found, supposedly the book that Josiah found in the temple, was actually the source of the law. And that's when, you know, that's the story that they think is, that gives great credence to the deed source, is that Josiah supposedly found this in the temple and used it to restore true worship in Israel.
Was that the 530 date as well? I can't see that number.
This is 550, when it was actually edited together with the JE source.
The other comment I wanted to make was about the word Jehovah. Yeah, I'm glad you pointed it out. I think it needs to be pointed out more and more. It's a bogus word. It is not a word from Hebrew or any other language. It's a bogus word that we've made today. And personally, I think we need to be careful on the names we refer to God by. I think if we were to take the word Clinton and president and come up with this bogus word, I don't think many of us would want to utter that word in front of Clinton and call him by that, or write if we were working for him. And it's the same way with the word Jehovah. It's a bogus word. The correct word pronunciation, as you said, is Yahweh. And Adonai is another word altogether. It's the word for Lord, as you pointed out.
One thing about the foolishness of this doctrine, you know, when I first encountered it in school, right away you could see, you know, this is really, the first thing that occurred to me is this is really subjective. It just seems like they're pulling things here and pulling things there and just making it fit. But I thought, at that time, but that can't be the case. You know, I'm just a stupid freshman, and these guys have studied this for years and years and years, and so surely down the line I'll read some more about this. But the more you read, the more it's clear that it's subjective.
Well, I appreciate what you said. I think this is kind of a follow-up on, I didn't hear who said it over there, but this reader-oriented philosophy, it is showing up in our school system among public education, because what's happening is at the elementary level, teachers are being trained to prompt students to, what does this mean to you? What does it mean to you? So what they're doing is they're kind of watering down the fact that there is truth out there. It's just truth has been redefined as what it means to you. So I see glimpses of that in the school system, the public school system. I don't know about the private school system, but I do see glimpses.
Of course, we said, like in a lot of modern day theological viewpoints, reader-centered interpretation comes out, but it's not stuff that we would accept. You know, this is kind of an answer to Richard's question about what does that have to do with us? But you do encounter people all the time when you talk to them that have this viewpoint about the scriptures. One great example of reader-centered interpretation of the Old Testament is liberation theologians. In the Catholic Church especially, there's a group that subscribe to liberation theology, where they accommodate all the texts in the Old Testament, the New Testament, about oppression of the poor, and use them to support communism as a valid political form. And in El Salvador, for instance, a lot of Catholic priests there were liberation theologians, and they were trying to get the Catholic peasants involved in the civil war in El Salvador using this liberation theology, telling them that Jesus actually promoted a violent overthrow of oppressors. but you have to go a long ways, you know, to get from what Jesus said about nonviolence to overthrowing governments. But that's what they could do in reader-centered theology. I asked one priest one time, it wasn't a priest, I think it was some minister in a Methodist church who was a liberation theologian. And I asked that person, have you ever considered the nonviolent teachings of Jesus? And the person said to me, just like this, he said to me, well, yes, and I have, and it kind of bothers me. Just like that. You know? It didn't keep them from their doctrine. Good comment.
Ron, you know, Ryan was speaking of reader-centered text. Isn't it really a symptom of the whole philosophy of objectivism that there's no truth? And I don't know what the name we have for it today, but, you know, our legal courts, the legal system is going through the same thing, and that everything is jury experienced.
Right.
That's something else. That is what I wanted to ask about. I have two questions. In this evolution of, monotheism to polytheism or the reverse, you know, Paul in Romans 1, he says, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, the God has shown unto them, and so on. This particular text, which is like natural revelation reveals there's a God and supernatural revelation reveals his nature. This passage, what can we do with this passage in terms of this monotheistic, polytheistic as far as what Paul said?
A lot. It's a powerful passage because the creation, and Paul says that, let me read it just so I can get it right. He says, since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, having been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. From the creation itself, from what has been made, you can see some certain things about God's eternal power and divine nature. You can show from the creation, I think, from the argument of first cause, that the creation has to have one first cause that was not caused by anything else. And that first cause is a singular cause that caused everything else. And that's what nature reveals about God, is that God is one. He's the first cause of everything else that was caused, and he himself had no cause. Then later, of course, when people rejected God as the one true God, they began to worship the creation, the creature instead of the creator. And that's what Paul brings out in that passage. And then that leads in turn to immorality. Because once you reject the oneness of God, the singularity of his being, then you reject his law too.
My second question is this. This kind of relates to what Richard was alluding to. Is this true or false? Typically speaking, when we begin to deal with a lot of commentaries, is it typically true that those who try to put a very recent date on most of the books, etc., pretty much tend or come out of a documentary theory type background? Would that be a proper statement or not?
Well, only in regards to the Old Testament, because this theory has only
well, has. I'm speaking of Old Testament. I'm taking someone who takes the book of Daniel. He doesn't want Daniel where he wants Daniel. He's got to get Daniel after the fact because he does not believe that this could be prophetic because, you know, there can't be inspiration. So I'm saying, in terms of, let's put that in terms of Old Testament books, that basically speaking, a little warning flag would be, look carefully if you see that this writer has tried to take the date and move it very close, as close as he can to it. That probably tells you there's something in his background that maybe is towards this. That's what I'm asking.
Sure. The documentary hypothesis, though, has particular relevance to the first five books of the Old Testament, but the general viewpoint of the Old Testament being a compilation of source material leads people to believe that large portions of it have much later dates than we would think. Not only that, that would indicate that, you know, there's always a tendency in agnostic commentators to imply that these men like Daniel didn't really know beforehand what was going to happen. These books were actually written after the fact, supposedly prophesying about something beforehand, but not really. they were written after the fact. And that's really what they're, I think, they're driving at. You know, is,
well, if you deny the ability to prophesy, you've got to come up with some explanation to get rid of it.
Right. That's right. It all starts from a super, it all starts from this presupposition of anti-supernaturalism or anti-divine intervention.
William Osborne.
As far as your literary criticism, offered text and reader-centered, of course, politically and, like you said, philosophically, today we're having trouble demanding that a truth exists, you know, in any objective form. But my question goes back to, we commonly assert that there's an author, hermeneutics anyway, supposed to be author-centered, author-intent. But what do you do with passages like 1 Peter 1, verse 11 and 12, where it says he was seeking to know the person or the time the Spirit of Christ within them was indicating. He predicted the sufferings of Christ, the glories to follow, was revealed to them. They were not serving themselves but you. Are we to take that passage and say most, as an author-centered hermeneutical study, we're forced to interpret those passages until we have specific reason to interpret them textually? Or is there a connection between those two? I'm not really sure how to ask the question. But
maybe this is taking it a step further, is if we think about author-centered interpretation, then Peter talks about the prophets of the Old Testament prophesying about the coming of Jesus, and some things that they prophesied about, they didn't actually understand themselves.
Right.
And so how could that be an author-centered interpretation? But the author really is not the prophet. The author is the Holy Spirit. And to properly interpret those passages, you have to take everything the Holy Spirit said through the prophets. And I think a validation of that approach is the fact that these prophets, when you take all their words together, and they form one singular picture, although they wrote in different cultures, in different times in the history of Israel, but you take their picture and put it together, you have one singular portrait of the coming of Jesus. You don't have one prophet who prophesied that the Messiah would come and establish a physical political empire, and have another that prophesied that he would come and establish a spiritual kingdom. Their views harmonize, and that validates the authorship of the Holy Spirit.
I agree with you, but I guess the way that I'm thinking of it is that someone who would deny supernaturalism and deny prophecy as a whole would say these are internal evidences for interpreting it textually rather than author interpretation. You know what I'm saying? They're saying this is evidence that would force it out of the author hermeneutic into the textual hermeneutic. And I agree with you. I believe it's all in the Spirit inspired. But well, the existence of prophecy as a statement, they would maybe use that as an argument for textual base.
Yeah, but the problem is they're starting from an incorrect beginning point, you know, assuming that you can understand a text. If you, in this way, you can't. The point is, you can't understand the meaning of a text this way. You can't understand the meaning of a text by just looking at the grammar. You have to know something about the author and what he meant by the grammar that he used. And you can't understand a text, certainly can't understand it by just reading it and thinking how it's structured.
Alan?
Raymond, a couple of comments on what Richard asked. Commentaries, we don't usually use these, but you see them around. The Interpreter's Bible Commentary appeals to JEDP throughout. Probably the Anchor Bible Commentary, I'm almost certain I've seen that. And Raymond Brown, who wrote a commentary on John and the birth and death of Christ, monumental, lengthy works. But there, he appeals to all of that. And I think these guys usually, like Ron said, who appeal to a recent date, usually do too. And a comment, I really appreciated what you said about literary criticism and its relationship to this author-centered, text-centered, and so on, and how the theology departments are late. All this stuff has been proved not effective. But I think that is creeping into the digressive church somewhat. They may not recognize they're doing that, because I don't think they, at least I don't think they intend to deny the inspiration of the Bible. But writers like C.R. Allen and the Cruciform Church and Michael Hughes, and I forget the name of his book about reviewing the Restoration Movement, and Richard Hughes, I mean, and Michael Weed, and then a kind of a pop reader-centered idea comes from Max Lucado and Lynn Anderson and Abilene, people like that, who are saying that, well, the Bible may say that, but what's important is what it means in our day to us, and so on and so forth. And they're arguing for a lot of changes in worship and in the work of the church based upon what is essentially or basic, fundamentally, a reader-centered view of the scriptures. And obviously that's led to a lot of problems.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of makes me, when I read some of that literature coming out of the Abilene, places like that, they talk about it as if it's a new thing, as if it's a new discovery. And it just cracks me up inside, because a lot of that stuff has already been proven ineffective in other circles, you know. In the philosophical circles, it's already been proven to be a dead end, and it's like they've discovered something new in magic, and you just know that where it's going to lead. It's going to either lead to their destruction, or they're going to finally give it up and say, you know, this is not what we thought it was.
Yeah, one more comment on what Dan was asking. That text, Clement says that it was the Spirit which was in them that signified these things, and I think that would be the answer to somebody who was arguing. Basis. And another thing, I wanted to ask this. I think I know your answer, but I think it needs to be said. This author-centered interpretation is to interpret it from an author-centered basis. It's not saying you don't interpret it grammatically and syntactically, right, and all of that. What this other view, text-centered, is saying is that the author and that context has nothing to do with what the text,
right,
says.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad you clarified that, because that's what I hope is clear, is that when you interpret something from an author-centered viewpoint, you still understand his grammar, because it's the author that's saying it, and what he's saying that's important. But in a text-centered interpretation, the author is completely disregarded. Completely disregarded.
Jamie? The grammar is necessary to understand.
Right.
You know, he's using that as a tool. I want to again comment on what Richard and Ron said, because I think that's real important. These people who do give late dates to these books are agnostic, and they come from that background. But it's also true of the New Testament, so I think that needs to be remembered too. The same agnosticism is found in the authorship of scholars who write commentaries on the New Testament as well. And it's pretty much a good guide. If you go in there and you pick up a book and you see they've got some real late date for Paul. Paul couldn't have written this. You see, he was dead already. You can. It's the same background, same philosophy that you're talking about here.
We have two more questions, and then we'll stop. James Orton, and then Glenn Osborne. James.
Actually, Alan's last salvo needed. I was thinking about the contextual interpretation, and that really is sort of a combination of the author and his text.
Yeah, you always have to take the text with the author. That's what you're interpreting.
Right.
And the text is the expression of the author. You know, the text is never an expression of itself. So you have to take the author. One point, too, in this regard is that a lot depends on the text itself as in regards to how much you need to know about the author. If you are, for instance, interpreting a piece of poetry that's full of imagery, you need to know more about the author, you know, and his particular background, and or the particular problems that he was expressing through the poetry, then you need to know about some historical narrative or some parable that contains the moral teaching at the end. Because there, when you see the moral teaching at the end, you know what the author's intent was to begin with. So it's not necessary that you know so many facts about, in every situation, about the author before you can really know what he's saying. It depends on the piece of literature.
I think you're absolutely right. That's especially true in the poetical writings of Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes. I mean, you've got to take it in the context of the way they use language, or you're not going to understand it. Some of the things they say. But I've talked to two preachers lately that are beginning, digressive preachers that are beginning to question the inspiration of scriptures based on reader-based interpretation. And that's where it led me to it, because one of them used this very passage to say the Bible intended for us to interpret the text based on a totally subjective means because of those passages. The authors didn't know what they were writing, and it's left up to us to interpret it. And that passage in particular was used by one man that has come to question the inspiration of Scripture. And that's where I think we're headed. I mean, that's where I think they're heading. And I think you're right. We need to come back. This is a critical point in history, not only politically and philosophically, but it's a point where we've got to defend the reality of a author-based hermeneutic.
Yeah, I'd like to just say something to you. Just that, I don't know, I hesitate to say this, but I do want to share it with you just because it helps me. It always reaffirms my faith when I think about it. But when I graduated, I wrote a paper against reader-centered hermeneutics, and that was the point of it. And I had a professor who was a professor of hermeneutics, and he was absolutely reader-centered. He'd written a book about the hermeneutic analysis based on a German hermeneutic philosopher named Gadamer. And his viewpoint, my professor's viewpoint, David Hoy, who was a golden boy at Yale in philosophy, claimed that it's impossible to understand a text. It's impossible to understand a text that's separated from you in time. And so I wrote my thesis against his book. And some of my friends at school said, you know, who are you going to have read your thesis? Because you have to have people to read it. You know? I said, well, I'm going to have David read it. You know? And they said, no, not David. You know? But it did. You know, and they have to have two readers. So I went in, my advisor read it. And then he said, well, my advisor and then David Hoy read it. And I went in for the oral. And my advisor first gave me a few criticisms, you know. And then he said, well, I'll let David have you now. You know, and so for about 20 or 30 minutes, he just said, what about this and what about that and what about this and what about that? But I really felt like I was there to honor the Lord, you know, and that was my whole purpose. And so it didn't bother me, you know, I just answered him according to what I had read and everything and defended author-centered interpretation. And this was a guy who had written major stuff in favor of reader-centered interpretation. So I went out, the two of them talked. I went back in. And David Hoy had a big smile on his face and said, I'm sorry, Raymond, instead of giving you a hard time, but you were right. And to me, that was the defense of the scriptures, because there's no way to understand the scriptures without an author-centered interpretation. And that always reaffirmed my faith, because there you could show that there's no other alternative than an author-centered viewpoint. And this very guy, you know, he would give lectures on Nietzsche or Heidegger in the philosophy class, and he would say how Nietzsche meant this and Heidegger meant that, you know, interpreting the writings of Nietzsche and Heidegger. And how could he do that? How could he say this is what this guy meant and then test you on it? He couldn't if he believed in a reader-centered viewpoint. And the fact is, they're not consistent. So the only reason why I say that is to say this, that we're not just sort of playing with scholars here and saying, you know, if they were here, they couldn't answer. But having the consolation that they're not here, and so they can answer, and that's good. They can't answer. They can't. That's the fact. You know, and reader-centered theology is leading the same place where reader-centered literature is going. It's going to absolute skepticism and agnosticism. It will go the same way. So it's true. It doesn't work. Tried it. Thank you. Thanks for the good questions. I didn't really know what people might answer or question or comments or questions people might make, but I really appreciate all the questions and comments. It really been good. It really helped me to think through the topic.